tonight on Arena. The Full Monty is back, this time a new 8-part Disney Plus series and new albums from Christine and the Queens, Niall Horan and Janelle Monáe up for review. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. To start this evening, when we talk about influential British bands, you'll always hear the names of the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, Led Zeppelin, and others might spring to mind as well. But let's set aside all the performative coolness and say, when it comes to pop, it would be wrong to understate the impact of the band Take That on the shaping of modern music from their early 90s beginnings through their superstardom of the mid-90s and the tabloid-tastic split in 1996. The five members of Take That were the boy band blueprint that launched so many imitators. Did any of the imitators have the charm or indeed the songwriting chops to match them? Next week, Take That get their own jukebox feature film musical. It's called Greatest Days. It stars our own Aisling B. And so to anticipate that, with me in studio this evening is Louise Bruton to talk about the impact of Take That on pop music. Let's start with the impact of Take That on Louise Bruton. What are your memories and what does Take That mean to you, Louise?
Take That were just the first everything. They were the first pop group, the first boy band, the first idols that were kind of handed to me. I remember having a folder in primary school that was my sister's, and when she was over Take That, she gave it to me, and I had crayon hearts drawn around.
Did she over Take That?
I know, can you imagine? But I had crayon hearts drawn around Robbie Williams's face, and it was just like pure dedication. Like the day that they split up, I remember walking into the schoolyard to just a sea of tears of 8-year-old girls knowing what heartbreak was.
8-year-old girls and some older girls and young women as well. Probably a sea of tears around many parts of this country and indeed other countries as well. You weren't alone in that, you know, super fandom of Take That, Louise. How did the band come about? Where did that idea come from? You know, people obviously, the Monkees was the first boy band, but Take That were something, they really were something different, weren't they?
Yeah, so their origins are completely different to what we know now, which is sort of balladeers. They were originally thrown together by this man named Nigel Martin Smith, who just wanted a bunch of good looking boys to dance in clubs, a bit like New Kids on the Block in America. But he managed to find five working class lads who were all teenagers, except for, I think, Jason Orange, who was the quadruple threat of a DJ, a dancer, a modeler and a vehicle painter. So they were all, and Robbie Williams used to be a body popper and he was 16 when he started in the band. So these are all boys who had left school and wanted to be something bigger than where they came from. So when they came together, they were thrown into nightclubs and they had television performances wearing mostly leather, having bleached hair, hints of homoeroticism to them. And it was suddenly when Gary Barlow's songwriting chops really came to the fore that they realised they could do more than just be good looking boys. They could be great singers and performers too.
So you've given us Jason Orange there, you've mentioned Robbie Williams and you've mentioned Gary Barlow. Lots of people would think of Gary and Robbie as the kind of the head. But who were the other two then to complete the quintet out?
Mark Owen was the cute one. I think that was the one that most young girls fancied. I think that was his role. That was also a great thing about Take That. Each one had their role. So the Jason Orange and then Howard Donald was the one for the mums to fancy. So everyone had their role to play. There was the talent in Gary, the cuteness in Mark, the older kind of suaveness in Jason and Howard, and then the cheeky chappy of Robbie Williams, who was the entertainer.
But the Gary Barlow aspect of things, and that those songwriting chops, that was vital really to all of the band really.
Yeah, it's probably what prevented them from an early demise, which is what happened to so many pop groups, especially in the 90s, where they're kind of hot for a minute and then they fade away into oblivion. But Gary Barlow, as much as it pains me to say, he really kind of kept the momentum going by outdoing himself with every song, every album, managing to do the fun songs like It Only Takes a Minute. Or sorry, that was a cover. There was a couple of covers that they did. But he would have done some of the mushier stuff like A Million Love Songs. But then he could come back with a song called Pray, which was just them dancing. Dancing under waterfalls.
There you go. Perfect. What more do you need? And I suppose 1991, the song Do What You Want kind of launched the whole thing. That was a big hit for them. But it was that cover. It was It Only Takes a Minute, really, that got things going. Let's remind ourselves what happened in 1992.
only takes a minute, girl.
There you go. There's the bit where all the lovely dancing was going to go on by those who could dance. But that's the version. They take that version of It Only Takes a Minute from 1992. And that really was the big splash, Louise.
That just took the UK, Europe, Ireland and Asia by total storm. And they didn't crack into America at that point yet. But neither did the Backstreet Boys, who were also American. It wasn't the taste for America but yet. But Europe, take that insane.
Robbie and Gary, really, I think to anybody, if you say take that, that's probably the first two names that you will hear. That dynamic, how important was it? There's a kind of a little underscore of rivalry from the very start, isn't there, really?
It was apparently a case of Robbie just not liking being told what to do. And because Gary had that sort of the songwriting kind of string on his bow, he probably had a bit more power in the band and he could determine how many ballads, how many fun songs they had. Whereas according to Robbie at the time, he was more into rap and hip hop, which is not what he ended up doing apart from that terrible album, Rude Box, in 2006. But it was just a case of egos clashing, and it was what would eventually lead to make Robbie leave the band.
All right, well, let's listen to an interview from, this is very close to the beginning, from 1991. In fact, even before that big hit with It Only Takes a Minute. Here they are starting out. They were asked about the name Take That, but I think even as you listen to the two of them talking, because it's predominantly Robbie and Gary that you, it is just Gary and Robbie that you hear here, you, even then you get a sense there's a little bit of tension there.
I think it was a joint effort, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was just, we wanted something really, really snappy and fast and Take That. I think
we'll tell you the real story. He got punched in the face and this fella said, Take That, right? And he said, Take That, what a good name for a band.
Yeah, that's right, that, yeah. It's good on Rob, yeah.
Amongst you all, obviously you're the lead singer, Gary, but is there sort of a boss amongst you? Who tends to sort of...
Our manager's our boss. No, it's not really like a lead singer even, because, I mean, there's so many personalities in the band. People usually say, yeah, is there one of you who talks more than the others? Well, I said, no, everybody's got equal amount to say, you know. So there's not really any leader in the band, you know.
And what about your songs? Do you write your own material?
Yeah, I write the songs.
Everything comes from within. Everything comes within.
Yeah, I think that's important, actually, because, I mean, you know, right from the beginning when the song's written, I'm thinking about what the lads can, you know, how they can make the routine up. And it's dead important, I think. It gives it its own style when everything's coming from within the band.
Gives a bit more cred as well.
I don't know who that third voice was. It was Gary at the end there. Gary and Robbie, rather, at the very end there. That's an interview from 1991 featuring Gary and Robbie, Gary Barlow, Robbie Williams from Take That. We're looking at the cultural impact of Take That this evening with Louise Bruton. So I maintain I could hear a little bit of tension, but just something, the way it was said around, you know, when he said, yeah, that's a funny one, all right. That he didn't think that was funny
at all.
Or just,
I'd write those songs and then the boys will come up with the dance routines, which was obviously, because a big thing when Robbie was in the band and then leaving the band was he was known as the fat dancer from Take That. So there was obviously a lot of tension between them and what their roles were. And even the idea of lead singer, which is something that we saw again in Boyzone, where the lead singing came down to Ronan and Stephen in Boyzone and the other three boys were there to kind of fill the stage, which is probably, it would kind of put down a lot of people if they realised that they were just filling a stage. And that's probably what Robbie felt.
Yeah, he felt a little bit of that. But then we have the phrase, doing a Robbie.
Doing a Robbie, yeah. He went out and he outshone them all. And for a while, Take That, I feel we're a bit of a laughing stock, because Gary Barlow tried to have a similar solo career and everybody believed that he would be the one to go out there and have the biggest success because he had the voice and he had the talent. But the thing that he doesn't really have, which Robbie has in droves, is charisma. And Robbie Williams became the biggest solo male act for probably about 5-6 years without fail.
And you talked about the moment of the split. It really was. I mean, it was a huge event. I remember the newsreels, the news bulletins at the time, full of people crying about the demise of Take That.
Yeah, and it was the type of thing that if we had as much kind of television coverage when the Beatles split, it would have been the same thing. But yes. It was just every news bulletin.
When was it actually? It was 1990.
It was February 1996, which...
February the 13th.
I know, terrible day. But
it
was
also... Day before Valentine's Day. Hearts broken beforehand.
But their breakup probably also paved the space in everybody's hearts for the Spice Girls who arrived then that summer. So it's almost like you can't have a boy band and a girl band. So for hearts to break, they had to mend with the power of wannabe then.
Oh, okay. That's very nicely put. So would you see then the Spice Girls, maybe a mirror image or some kind of, you know, accompaniment to Take That, or, you know, running alongside them? Because if you look at what came subsequently, was there anybody really who matched the boy bandishness of Take That?
The way the pop world works is everything is a reaction of something else. So because a boy band was so successful, the marketing heads had to be like, a girl band now has to be successful to take over. And then the pure poppedness of the female girls, Spice Girls, meant that something a bit cooler, like All Saints, had to come along. And when you look at the timeline of boy bands, Take That were dancing shirtless under waterfalls. And when you come to 2013, when One Direction launched, they refused to dance. They refused to be just cute boys, which age 16 they were.
Well, let's have a listen to Robbie on the split with the band. Here he is talking to Chris Evans. And if anybody was going to cause trouble with him, it was going to be Chris Evans. So Robbie Williams talking about the band split.
I mean, how do you feel about Gary and Jason and Mark and Howard now?
Well, it's obvious that if you're dictated and conditioned for so long into a certain regime, that you're going to carry on with the same thing. And the boys, bless them, don't know anything different to what they're in.
Do you still think they're being told what to say?
I don't believe for one instance they're being told what to say. There's nobody going, you say this, you say that. But there's somebody guiding them around it. Now, there's somebody guiding them to tell what they've got to say.
Bearing in mind all that's happened, right, and... Do you regret... I just want a yes or no from you now, Bob. Do you regret leaving Take That when you did?
Yes or no? No. No, I didn't leave, I was sacked.
Yeah, I know, no. It doesn't matter how you left.
But
would you have preferred to have been there and done a farewell tour without leaving? Because it was only six months after...
I would have loved to have done the tour. Right. I was going to leave Christmas, I would have loved to have done the tour.
So you're still happy that you left?
I couldn't be more happy than I am now. I'm doing my own thing. Right. I'm writing my own stuff.
Robbie Williams there talking about the demise of the temporary demise of Take That, it has to be said, because everybody thought, well, that's it. How can they ever get back together again? There must have been an incredible row. And I think everybody knew it was Robbie and Gary, really, didn't they?
It was Robbie and Gary. But then in 2005, they did the unexpected and came back as a four piece, almost bigger than ever. And it was kind
without
Robbie. Mm-hmm. Robbie was still quite successful in his solo career, but he was on the downturn. And their reunion probably shaped the rest of pop reunions from that point on. So there wouldn't have been a Spice Girls reunion in 2007. It wasn't for Take That, because Take That came back with music that was almost better than what they initially released, with songs like Patience and Smile, which Lily Allen said was such a good song that she stole the melody from one of her own albums and just gave them credits on the album. It was just one of those things.
Let's have a listen to a clip from The Late Late Show 2010, because this is they're back together now at this stage. And again, they were so clever at how they could handle media when the awkward questions were asked.
It was difficult for me and Rob, definitely. But I think outside of me and Rob, there weren't any other real problems within the band.
Yeah.
So once that was done, and that was done pretty quick, wasn't it, Rob?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Instantly. Yeah.
Once that was done, it was absolute plain sailing.
Instantly?
Yeah, well, he apologised for nicking my tatoes back in the day. Salt and vinegar tatoes, that's where it started.
So it was a crisp issue, was it?
Yeah.
Okay, so you guys got over that then and felt if that was the immovable object that changed everything when you got it together. And did you miss then, since you've been back with Take That, have you missed the freedom that you indulged yourself in by being a solo artist?
No, you know, I suppose I'm a bit like a child that just needs to be guided in the right direction.
Yeah.
And I've been missing somebody to go, no, actually, I disagree, it should be this way and we should do it that way. I'm loving being part of a team. Everywhere we go, it's like doing a lap of honour and people are smiling and happy to see us. right now, it's very, very special to be Take That and to be in Take That and to be part of this.
And, you know, you kind of believe him when he says that. I don't know whether it is all schmaltz. What do you think?
I was just about to, like, you don't believe a word he's saying. Because he only stayed with them for one album.
All right.
And then he didn't come back and he didn't perform with them at the Olympics in 2012. His wife was giving birth now, in fairness. But
yeah,
there was a thing where he kind of wanted to see if he could almost wield the power to come back in and have big success, because they had, I think, a number one single with The Flood, but then he left again.
Okay, we have spoken a lot about, I suppose, the split and all of that side of things and the dynamic in the band, but the songwriting, we shouldn't forget. I gave you the choice. I was kind of thinking about Back for Good, but I suppose Patience is probably a better song, is it?
Well, they all have their place in the canon of great music. Back for Good, I think, is just a perfect pop song. And I think anybody in any generation would probably know all of the ad-libs, all of the key changes off by heart. But Patience was just remarkable in that they just came back with a new wave of magic. And it's a universal pop song in that sense, where everybody can enjoy it.
All right. Well, let us finish up with Patience then from Take That. Louise Bruton looking at the story of the boy band that was Take That. That is Take That.
Just have a little patience. I'm still hurting from a love I lost. I'm feeling your frustration. A little patience.
Patience, the title of the song there from Take That, and it was Louise Bruton who was bringing us through the history of the band to start out tonight's programme. Taking place 25 years after the original film, The Full Monty is an 8-part series that follows the same band of brothers as they navigate the post-industrial city of Sheffield, society's crumbling healthcare, education and employment sectors. The series looks at what happened to the gang after they put their kit back on. It reunites the original cast, including Robert Carlyle, Tom Wilkinson and Mark Addy. The original 1997 movie won an Oscar and was nominated for 3 others. Mary McGill has been watching the new series, 8-part series, The Full Monty, and she joins me now. Mary, you're talking about Take That and splitting up and the Spice Girls. I thought we're kind of heading towards The Full Monty. That's exactly where we are. 1997. It was a huge success at the time, this film.
To put it in context, this film was made for a budget of $3.5 million. It grossed $250
million. Wow.
For a time, it was the most successful British film ever, until Titanic knocked it off the top of the box office in the UK. So this was a film that, going by the budget, nobody saw coming. But the minute it was released to huge critical acclaim. Audiences couldn't get enough of it. And it just had this brilliant, personal, tender mix of the heart, the humour and the political. It just was a masterstroke of storytelling that captured, obviously, the story of these men in Sheffield, but also spoke to wider trends in the culture. I mean, you know, we're obviously going to be talking about Robert Carlyle as Gaz. The year before, he played Begbie in Trainspotting.
Yeah.
And again, you know, you have these men on the fringes of society, this really disenfranchised group. And there just seemed to be something in the culture. And of course, Take That themselves are from working class backgrounds. You know, there was this kind of sense of, you know, the North and other parts of the UK, you know, that had been overlooked and so badly let down by economic policy, but that there was this tremendous groundswell of talent coming from these regions, and they had something really important to say about the state of the nation. And it was just, those figures again, such a tiny budget,
yeah.
$250 million, and like a hugely popular film, not just in the UK, but right around the world. I mean, the Full Monty was an absolute triumph when it was released in 1997.
And I'm sure it caused many's a workforce to nominate 5 or 6 men to go and do a Full Monty and to do the striptease in terms of raising funds or whatever it was, finding money for good causes, because that's what it was about. And it was about how these men, it became a real community. There was a real sense of community. That was what was present in that film.
Absolutely. I mean, these men, you know, that their connection to each other was they'd either worked together as steelworkers or they were hanging out together in the job centre all day. And, you know, Robert Carlyle's character, Gaz, was motivated by family concerns. He was going to be sued if he, you know, didn't find the means to pay for child support. He wouldn't get to see his son. So again, issues around, you know, father's rights, issues around the breakdown of the family, but also the role that those men played for each other in being friends and enabling them to kind of, you know, fight back against the system, if only for one night, Sean. Like, they only did the full monthly once, you know. that was the glory of it.
Yes.
But I think, you know, it's a film, I think, that, you know, is still looked back on very, very fondly. So in one sense, it's not surprising that Disney have gone to that source material and gone, aha, what can we do with that then in the present day?
I must say my heart sank when the opening captions came up and said 26 years ago. And then, so yeah, and we get a little clip of back in the day or pictures from back in the day. Then we had 7 prime ministers, and I can't remember the exact phrase, but 8 rejuvenation projects for Northern England later. Yeah. And they bring us through, you know, potted history of the prime ministers, you know, most of them in the last 80 to 24 months, let's be honest, you know, ironically.
Yeah.
But I thought, oh, this is on the nose from the very start, in a way that the film just wasn't.
Yes, this pulls no punches. I mean, that first episode, Sean, is called Leveling Up. And Leveling Up, for people who don't know, is a literal title of numerous, some would say very failed, policies introduced by Conservative governments to try and level up, you know, the northern and regional parts of the UK in comparison to London, which has, you know, developed so rapidly over the last 20 years. You know, a lot of people would say that just hasn't happened. So the full Monty, right from the get-go, is talking to this politics, right? It is saying, look, we were left behind in 1997. That trend has not been reversed.
Yeah. And the first character, or practically the first character we meet in today's full Monty, is Gaz, Robert Carlyle himself. Mm. And again, you think, God, has anything changed for this man, or has it just got worse?
Yes, indeed. Well, he's carting around a mattress that he's found somewhere, you know, and endeavouring to get on the bus, you know, and you know, Gaz is kind of the classic guy who's always coming up with the harebrained scheme. He's all, you know, the good luck is just around the corner. He just needs to figure it out. So he's, you know, things mightn't have changed for Gaz, but he might be down, but he's certainly not out. But who we also meet, and, you know, there's a real kind of, again, that bittersweetness. We also are very quickly introduced to his semi-estranged daughter named Destiny, played by newcomer Talitha Wing, who does a great job here. But you get a sense very quickly that the economic choices that have so impacted her father's life are also encroaching on her life as well.
But we do get a sense, I mean, the son that he had been fighting for custody for and all of that in the film back in 1997 has now done reasonably well for himself, and, you know, which was a nice twist and a turn.
Yes, and I'm laughing because that son is now a police officer.
Yeah.
If you know the character of Gaz, you'd be like,
last person you'd say you think they would have a police officer as a son.
Absolutely. But of course, he himself now is a father to, you know, Ben, played by Lewis Wheel. But Ben is in a wheelchair. And you know, there's a really, again, poignant scene where Gaz, you know, and Ben are chasing each other around in motorised wheelchairs. But Ben can't afford a motorised wheelchair, you know, and neither can Gaz. Yeah. So, you know, you're constantly being confronted by, and as with the film, you know, these lovely moments of freedom and joy, often brilliantly soundtracked. And, you know, again, we get that here. But then the reality sets in and you come back down to earth with a bang.
Now, it gets into the whole attitude to Brexit. It gets into several things that have happened in terms of social history in the last 26 years. Me Too is in there. Brexit is in there. Political correctness is in there. But the guys in what is now the wonderfully named Big Baps. That's the name
that's
of the cafe. That's
the
name of it, of course. Yeah. Reference to the bread. That's all it is. We know that. Ha ha. The way they are together let's have a listen to the clip, actually, of all of them together. This is Robert Carlyle as Gaz, Mark Addy as Dave, Hugo Spear as Guy, Paul Barber as Horst, Steve Houston as Lumper, Wilm Snape as Nathan, and Tom Wilkinson as Gerald, all meeting in the cafe, and they're discussing what they can and can't say anymore.
A dog. One Britain's Got Talent. Is that what I'm hearing? A dog?
Yep, clever little bugger.
Is that what goes for talent these days? Forget about William Shakespeare, for instance.
Oh, Shakespeare's dead.
Or Winston Churchill.
Also dead.
So what about Jane Austen, Queen Victoria, or the Beatles? I don't know. Picasso, for God's sake.
Dead? Dead. Mostly dead. In Spanish. Not really picking up the clues here, are you, Gerald?
But a dog says it all, doesn't it? Exactly what's wrong with this country.
On the contrary, that's democracy at work, that is.
Democracy? You'll be having it up for Prime Minister next.
Perfectly possible. As a matter of information, Caligula made his horse a Roman consul.
Shut up.
I'd vote for that dog. I think it's rather sweet.
She couldn't be worse than what we've got already.
Is it to take away?
What?
Your tea, sir. To take away?
No, why would it be?
Because if you don't zip it, I'll be throwing you out. There'll be no politics chat in the Big Baps, thank you very much.
I wasn't being political, was I?
Everything's political.
So, what am I allowed to say?
Glad you asked.
Free speech is a fundamental human right, Dennis.
Not in the Big Baps, it's not.
Sorry.
And that's a scene there from The Full Monty, the new television series, from the opening episode, in fact, featuring all of the characters, really, from the film. If you remember the film, you'll know who all of those guys were. But Mary McGill has been watching it for us. Who's responsible for the writing here, Mary?
Some of the original screenwriters from the film are back on board here. Mm. And you can really hear the Sheffieldness coming through there with the characters. Yeah. And that's one thing I absolutely loved about the original film, is that it embraced the local dialect so much. And it really, I think, gives a sense of place. And that was a big appeal in the 90s, yeah. I think is even more of an appeal now, you know, the turn of phrase, the slagging is magnificent, Sean, absolutely magnificent. The terms of endearment, you know, the kind of richness that you get in a regional sense. So the writing is, and it's very funny, it still has that.
Well, I was going to ask you about that scene. I mean, it kind of hits all of the, you know, all of the themes of Brexit are in there, aren't they? You know, political correctness and let's get back to the great country that we're. All of those things are touched on in that clip. My memory of the film is a much more nuanced treatment of the politics and the social situation. Do we get that in the television series?
I have to say, I found this a lot more uneven than the film. And what I mean by that is, I think you're absolutely right. The film just struck this wonderful balance between being a story of friendship, making a political commentary, holding a mirror up to society, but also having tremendous fun. I mean, The Full Monty is really funny. The film is great. You know, you invest in these guys and you want to see them succeed, you know. And I think it was just, you know, it got everything it wanted to do in the right amounts and balanced it beautifully. There's a lot more going on in each of these, their hour-long 8 episodes. And I felt at times, that scene in the cafe was beautifully done, but I did feel at times that there's so much going on that balance will be very hard to achieve anyway, but sometimes it gets lost. So you have stronger storylines that kind of have energy taken away from them because there's so much else going on. Now, it is because the writers have so much to work with, because the themes of the
original
film...
Having all the cast as well, all of that cast back.
All of that cast back and in great form and clearly enjoying themselves. And they were a great cast to begin with. You know, they can handle the political material, they can handle the humour. They're great together. It's such an ensemble piece. But again, you know, you have the original gang of 6 men. That's a lot of people to be dealing with anyway. And then you bring in all of these other characters too, younger people, you know, family members and so on. And I just, the good intentions almost kind of overwhelm themselves, right. You know, because there's so much going on.
Important final question, because obviously we had to wait for nearly the tail end of the film, The Full Monty, to get The Full Monty. Will there be any clothes removed during the 8-part series?
I feel like I need hot chocolate or Tom Jones this is for this, probably Sean.
We're probably not allowed to say this, are we?
We are not allowed to say this. We are not. But I don't think the reveal is as spectacular the last time round, put it that way. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, you should probably watch the film before you see the TV
series. Before you see the TV series. Yeah. Is it worth sticking with it for the 8 episodes?
Look, I enjoyed what I've seen. I think fans of the original film will probably stick with it because they love the characters. I did wonder to myself, if I hadn't seen the film, what would this mean to me? And I'm not sure for younger people that it would necessarily grab them in the same way.
Okay, that's Mary McGill speaking to us about The Full Monty. Begins on Disney Plus on June the 14th. And so to our album reviews on this Friday evening. And there we were talking about Take That earlier on. Niall Horan was just 16 when he auditioned for The X Factor in 2010. And despite having achieved just third place with One Direction, sons of Take That in some ways, in the final, it did not stop them conquering the world. Now the band members pursue solo careers. Niall releases his third album today, a more mature sound with the title at any rate called The Show. Next up, Janelle Monáe, American singer, rapper and actress, acclaimed for her first three albums with a sense of adventure. Her latest release, The Age of Pleasure, is unashamedly an hedonistic affair, described in one reviewer as, quote, hazily intoxicated, a hazily intoxicating cocktail of sex and partying. And finally, I can hardly breathe after that, French singer Eliose Letizia, known to many fans as Christine and the Queens, releases album number 4 today, 9 years since the widely acclaimed debut Chaleur Humaine. There's a gig planned for the RDS in November to support this album. The album is called Paranoia, Angels, True Love. Kind of a three-part title, three-part album. Andrea Cleary and Brian Boyd have been listening to the albums. They're with me in studio this evening. Let's start close to home. Mullingarmer, Niall Horan. The Show is the title of the album, and here's a track called Meltdown. When it all melts down, I'll be there.
Talking to yourself in the bathroom, losing your mind in the mirror like you have to.
Little taste of Meltdown there from The Show, new album from Niall Horan and Andrea Cleary and Brian Boyd. As I said, our reviewers on this Friday evening. This is Niall Horan's third studio. I feel like I can call him Niall because he really does feel like the fella next door. It's hard to dislike him. But like the previous albums, you know, that song is 2.5 minutes long. We heard about a minute and a half of it there. Clean as a wisp. You know what you're getting when you start it up, Brian.
And there's four professional songwriters making that 2 minutes and 31 seconds.
Yeah.
The problem with this album is I came out of it not knowing a thing about Niall Horan or what he stood for or what he wanted to express. The guy has stories, plucked off the streets of Mullingar, becomes a member of one of the biggest boy bands in history. There's no stories here. There's no. The two singles are very slick. They're very, you could put any vocalist on those. That's the problem with it. It's very generic. You could put me as a vocalist and auto-tune me on those two singles and it'd be a hit. The really strange thing here with Niall Horan in this album is that with his last album, when he toured it, he played theatres. With this album, he's going out on a world tour and he's playing arenas. Now, this is why we've seen a three-line whip by his record company in recent weeks. He's been on the front cover of every single... The record company are going, Niall needs to play arenas, he needs to sell seats, and they've imposed a three-line whip on the media and there's been all these fawning interviews. The guy has nothing to say. I'm sure he's a lovely guy. He's very little musical ability. He would not have a record deal if he looked like me, Sean.
But he can sing now, in fairness.
Yes, he has a good voice.
As a
former directioner, I will tell you that not only can Niall sing, he was the only member of that band who could play the guitar during the One Direction years.
And you are not, famously, as far as my memory goes, not a big fan of the singer-songwriter, guitar player, young male.
No, and I'm suitably torn because I really, with all my heart, wish Niall all the best. And I do call him Niall. But look, yes, I think he basically doesn't really let us in here. And I absolutely agree with Brian that there are stories to be told and even just, you know, maybe a bit of a reckoning with fame or his version of fame that he seems to have carved out for himself that is largely absent here. This is a kind of a pleasant enough album where he tries to hit a sweet spot between kind of heartfelt guitar and piano ballads and sing-along hits. And in that sense, he's succeeded. But we don't really get a sense of the guy himself.
Yeah, because I mean, I've seen interviews with Niall Horan in recent times. Maybe I'm thinking a couple of years back. Maybe it was with the last album, and you got the sense of this honest to God young man who actually cared about stuff and had strong opinions on certain things. You want to hear some of that in the songs.
He's very grounded. He's very down to earth. He's very personable. He's got, as I said, he's got this great story from Mullingar to a global globetrotting guy.
Tell us a bit of it.
And also, if you're going to, if you live in the musical shadow of Harry Styles, his ex-bandmate, why release an anemic Harry Styles sound? all these songs here. Some of the songwriters who write for Harry Styles write for Niall Horan.
On the
album.
Weekend, Harry Styles is slain, isn't he?
Tomorrow.
Harry Styles is tomorrow. Yeah. So, I mean, he had a chance to go out and do something individual, even eccentric, because, you know, all the One Direction money is behind Harry Styles commercially. Niall had a chance to actually do something, even like an acoustic album, a covers album. He's just released an anemic version of Harry Styles.
All right, let's have a little bit of a listen to If You Leave Me, just to round up. You Leave Me, the title of that song from Niall Horan from the new album, The Show. So, Andrea, I presume you're heading to Slane, by the way, tomorrow night, are you?
I absolutely am. And I'll be crossing my fingers that Mr. Horan will make a little appearance.
Well, you know, the songs that you heard in this album, because you hadn't, as Brian was saying, out in this big stadium tour, this big arena tour, has he got the songs that will fill that type of space?
Well, I think, funnily enough, there's a song on this, or actually, it's If You Leave Me as well as Save My Life. I think in particular, If You Leave Me sounds like it could be on Harry's House, which is Harry Styles' latest album, and Save My Life is a really nice kind of surprise with these kind of shimmering synths and 80s electric guitars that I think would have been a really nice direction for him to go in. But I mean, look, if he just walks out and waves at us, I'll be
delighted.
You'll
be happy. But you do have to give a star rating to this album, and you have to be objective.
I will. Look, I know we've been kind of sticking the boot in a bit, but I do think overall there's really nice vocal performances on this album, and he's started out as a vocalist, and I think his voice has only gotten better. The songwriting isn't there, it is bland, so I'm going to go with 2.5 stars.
2.5. What are you saying, Brian?
Just to put in context, what he's trying to do with this album is to go from playing Olympia, Dublin Olympia type shows to Dublin 3 Arena type shows. Wrong album. Nice guy, hopeless album. 2 stars.
2 stars, not happy, clearly. Right, that is The Show from Niall Horan, and let's hope he does give a little appearance at Slane for you, Andrea, just for you tomorrow night. And that'll be for giving him that extra half, possibly. Now, Janelle Monáe, singer, writer, artist, non-binary, Afrofuturist and an actor. Recently we saw in the film The Glass Onion. This is with her third album. This current album is her third album, The Age of Pleasure. And this is a track called Phenomenal. No, it's not a track called Phenomenal. This is a track called Lipstick Lover.
Lipstick lover, 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 lover. My lipstick lover, lover, lover. I like lipstick on my neck. You let me know I'm your number one select. I like lipstick on my neck. Hands around my waist so you know what's coming next. I wanna feel your lips on mine.
Lipstick Lover from Janelle Monáe and her album called The Age of Pleasure. I mean, The Age of Pleasure says it all. And if you listen closely to those lyrics, I'm sure there are all sorts of coded references in those lyrics that I don't understand.
There's a lot of pleasure going on in that album.
Yeah, very hard to find a lyric that you could play from the album. In fact, I did say Phenomenal, but you couldn't play Phenomenal on lots of the tracks on this album.
Very sensuous, very graphic, explicit. But no harm in that. But this isn't really an album. It's 30 minutes. And there's 14 songs. So you get like 1 minute songs. The whole idea about this, and I actually like the idea, it's Janelle Monáe saying, you know what, I've done all this acting, I've done all this thing, and I've released these amazing albums. And she is a great musician. She's inspired by Prince, and she really carries his torch musically with her funk and her rock. But she said with this album deliberately, look, I'm going to release an album all about pleasure. It's going to be very positive. It's very good. It's going to be very upbeat. What we're getting is basically a pool party soundtrack. I mean, you could hear the reggae there and, you know, you hear vintage funk. It's all very one-dimensional in that respect. I don't think she wants this to be taken seriously as an album as such. It's her with an interlude going, I'm just going to do a nice, relaxing, fun, sensuous bordering on the explicit. You really do feel like you're at a pool party. You're knocking back drinks. The vibes are fantastic.
And the further the album goes on, the riskier it gets in some ways.
Well, the alcohol intake. So from that context, yes, it's a great piece of work. From the context of does it work as an album? Not really.
Musically, what's she doing here? And we should point out, because I did say she's not a non-binary Afrofuturist. She goes with either the she pronoun or the they pronoun. Yes. Andrea, musically, what is she doing here? They are short. They are. Is there a tune here you couldn't dance to? I don't think there is.
No, definitely not. And I agree that this shouldn't really be taken as an album in the same way that, say, Beyoncé's Renaissance was a celebration of kind of queer identities. But she stress tested these songs at parties for her friends. Now, the parties that Janelle Monáe goes to are the Met Gala after party. So it's not your South Dublin house party. And she had the stipulation that if the songs can't work at the party, they're not going on the album. And she wanted it, she says, to be specific to a Pan-African crowd who are her friends, and wanted it to be a love letter to the diaspora. So there is a kind of wide ranging kind of sounds here, but they do fit together quite well. A lot of the songs are very short. It's kind of like she got a hook into her head and just laid it down and didn't spend much more time with it than she needed to. And I think that's fine. In terms of an album, it can be a little bit frustrating because some of these songs I would like to hear like a 4, 5, 6 minute kind of
version of it.
But
It's so theatrical, I suppose, and something. She is a very theatrical performer. I kind of wanted that aspect of it. Dare I say, I wouldn't have minded a concept album here.
I wouldn't have minded it either. I came away from this wanting more from this sound and wanting to kind of dive into the idea of the art of pleasure and not just kind of hear songs describing pleasure, but, you know, Janelle Monáe is an artist who really investigates these topics. And I thought that investigation or that unpicking was missing from this album.
Yeah, I'm going to play it. It's a kind of a cover version, this really, isn't it? Only of Eyes 42, it's written to us, but Only of Eyes 42 is obviously what we're dealing with here.
I like to love with my eyes closed. I try not to lead with my ego.
I like that version of Only Have Eyes 42 from Janelle Monáe and her current album, The Age of Pleasure. Overall, what are you saying, Brian, and stars?
That's the first time I've heard steel drums on any album I've reviewed on Arena. I love hearing those steel drums. They put you in a very sort of summery mood. It's a very good album for what it is. 3 stars only because it's just a disposable party album. I'm not being po-faced about it, but I'm just thinking in the overall narrative arc of Janelle Monáe's career, this will be seen as just, and then she did this disposable album.
Yeah, and I'm always saying here, put less on the album, but in this case you wanted more on the album. Yeah. So what are you saying here, Andrea?
I think if this album was released by anybody other than Janelle Monáe, we might be having a different conversation. But because the back catalogue is there, because everything she's done so far has been so strong, we have the right sort of context for this. And I do also think that if we start dissecting fun too much, we'll kind of forget how to
have it.
So I'm going to say 3.5.
From you on this one. That's Janelle Monáe, The Age of Pleasure. Let's move on then to our final album. French singer Elio's Laetitia, known to many fans as Christine and the Queens, releases album number 4 today, 9 years since the widely acclaimed debut, Chaleur Humaine. New album is called Paranoia Angels True Love. Christine and the Queens, much anticipated tour coming to the RDS in November. Again, we've got a pronoun question to clear up in the case of Christine and the Queens. Brian?
Uses he.
Is what?
Well, asks us to use
he.
We need to respect the decision of the artist.
Let us do as he asks. So who are we talking about when we talk about Christine and the Queens?
electro-pop artist that really came to prominence in 2014 with a series of fantastic synthy, poppy, bouncy singles. But his real strength is like sort of a Kate Bush or a Bjork. He has pushed the boundaries of what pop music is. Essentially, he is a pop musician. I mean, there are melodies aplenty here, but always he's looking to push the boundaries, to break the conventions. This is a remarkable piece of work. It helps to know that it's very loosely based on a very famous Broadway play from the 1980s called Angels in America, which was Tony Kushner's seven-and-a-half-hour play. Mm. Now, that piece of theatre itself broke a lot of the conventions on Broadway. It dealt with how the AIDS epidemic impacted on New York, the New York gay community. And that play in itself has given Chris an idea that you could somehow be inspired by this. This is really a piece of work of musical theatre. It's an hour and a half.
Yeah.
It's not now. Most albums, Sean, are 40 minutes. This is 90 minutes.
It's really it's not quite a triple album, but it's a three-part album in some ways. And let's have a listen to a track, and this is from the first part. The three parts being Paranoia, Angels, and True Love. From the first part of the album, then, this is a track called Tears Can Be So Soft. Tears Can Be So Soft, the second track, in fact, on the album Paranoia, Angels and True Love from Christine and the Queens. And I was saying, Andrea, as we were listening to that, I wanted way more time with this album. Mm. Part of the reason was that I don't know how many times I listened to that track, but I kept going back to listen to it because it really pulled me in. But you really need time for this album, this three-part album.
You do. I mean, any time that we gained with Janelle Monáe's short album, we certainly made up for this week with Christine and the Queens. That song in particular, I think, is a highlight on that album. It reminds me of Massive Attack. It reminds me of Bjork. But it's also very much him and himself, you know, dealing with, well...
Death of his mother.
Grief is a very, very big part of this album. Chris lost his mother in, I think, 2018, 2019, and has been going on this sort of journey to do with, obviously, Angels with the play. Mm. But there's also, you know, there's guest spots from Madonna here, who plays a kind of a disembodied, like a character of a disembodied mother figure. It's... like sometimes it's like a rock opera. It's amazing.
However, and maybe this is a case of needing more time with it, you know, does it all work, or is there any, were there sections on there, Brian, where you thought, well, maybe you could lose that and make it a bit shorter?
This could have collapsed like a bad souffle from within. It's because it's so, the themes, I mean, she's going from the elegiac to the joyful. Mm. He's going from all these themes, and this could have collapsed from within, but he holds it all together, and it's almost a hallucinogenic journey you're going on, and you really have to. It's just from the very first song, you're sort of going, his voice is just a thing of wonder. It's a thing of beauty. And it's very rare that you'll get, I mean, Chris has released these beautiful synth pop, almost like Aha type singles, and they're wonderful. But this is like a significant artistic achievement. And just very quickly, it reminds me of one of the most famous Irish musicians, Phil Chevron, who brought theatre into music and best known for Ghost Town with the Raiders. Four and a half. A great artistic achievement.
Great artistic achievement. What are you saying overall, Andrea?
I think it's a long album. It doesn't all quite work for me, but that's not to say that it won't work for me in the future.
Yeah,
you know, I've been listening to it for about a week now. Every time I listen to it, I like it more. There's one track in particular that feels a bit cheesy to me, which uses the kind of the Canon and D.
Pachelbel Canon.
I just didn't like, but it's going to be four stars from you.
So pretty high scoring indeed there for Christine and the Queens. Paranoia, Angels, True Love, the title of that album. Janelle Monáe's The Edge of Pleasure, Niall Horan's The Show, the previous two albums from Andrea Cleary and Brian Boyd on this Friday evening. Paul Newman or Robert Redford was what we were looking for in terms of our tickets or competition this evening, and tickets to the Pavilion Theatre to see Mojo Mickey Bo by Owen McCafferty. Robert Keelty, or Keelty it would be, I would say, yes, from Fairview, straight in with both names. Well done to you, Robert, and enjoy that play and indeed the dinner beforehand that you're getting too. But that is our lot for this Friday evening. Michelle Gibson was the broadcast coordinator. Leah Murphy researched. Ruth Kennington was on sound this evening. Tonight's programme was produced by Olin McGann. Back with you Monday at 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. And apologies to John Creedon, we're a bit late. He'll be with you after the news.